Okay, great. I imagine folks are going to be filtering in. You know, Brian Dickinson, I've always wanted to give a talk in his room here. Because you know, a lot of science folks have been stuck. So I'm going to talk to you about some of the science projects we've done on the farm and what it's going to entail is me giving you a few vignettes of things that other folks have been involved in and then actually a little bit more details on the kinds of things I've been doing. I'm actually a cell biologist and not involved in my own research in anything having to do with sustainable agriculture, but got interested in the farm, as many, I think, folks have. So the first project is actually done by an ecologist in the biology department looking at snake ecology research, in which he's been having students actually look at snake populations in the farm, but also build shelters for these snakes in the effort to try to actually increase the predator population on the farm. He's also comparing the snake populations you see in the farm to a wild, quote-unquote, habitat as well. And that's part of this the project. These are actually two students that worked last summer as part of this effort. They do some marker capture experiments, too, to measure population levels. I have a neuroscientist colleague, Tony Pyres, who gives this really interesting, it's actually integrated into a teaching laboratory in biology and behavior course, which is sort of a classic problem for this orientation behavior lab, where you actually allow bees from an existing hive to actually orient the different sources of food that you place in various portions away from the hive, and you can actually test aspects of whether you can actually increase or decrease response time according to how the quality of the food that you place there. He used to actually have students place the numbers on the bees, and there's actually little kits you can buy that have the little numbers, believe it or not. And you can place them on the bees, but now they actually just do a little bit of paintbrush. So this is a way to integrate what is a neuroscience aspect of behavior of animals with a common farm process, namely having honeybee hives. And interesting enough, the honeybee hives this year are actually in really good shape. I'll keep our fingers crossed. It's not clear what's happening with colony collapsing factor, of course. But also, there's a fellow who teaches in environmental science and studies at Dickinson, a guy named Gene Wingert, who's actually in himself an incredible resource for us. He's a natural historian. There's no other way to describe him. He's someone who has essentially grown up in the area, has intimate knowledge about the plants, animals, environments of central Pennsylvania. He's one of these also extraordinary sort of amateur videographers who has captured, you know, spotted salamander mating behavior. I mean, it's just amazing stuff. So he's actually, as part of an Audubon-funded project, is building a bluebird houses in a trail around the farm, but of course he's using it also as a way for his students to do research about things like what species are occupying these boxes, what species are occupying these boxes in different habitats. He's looking for also an aspect of integrated pest management, but of course the birds are function very well as insectivores. He's also looking at these boxes as habitats for mites in the wintertime, and so he has a number of different student projects related to these boxes. He's even extended these boxes on campus, too, in the same way. So he has the students build them, has them place them, he has them monitor them, all that kind of thing. We also there also is sort of a longstanding work on native pollinators out at the farm, actually done from a researcher at Penn State, and looking at native pollinators, and actually they're looking at both population densities and species diversities, but also efficacies as well. And there's a series of other projects that have been done. Alliance for Aquatic Resource Monitoring is actually a high-profile, citizen-based aquatic monitoring that's run out of Dickinson and actually came out of the era of acid rain and has developed into a monitoring statewide. And they have a project looking at effects of agriculture on the Yellow Breeches, which is the stream that runs just to the south of the Dickinson College Farm, which is actually a world-class trout stream, believe it or not. And There's also been, speaking of streams and hydrogeology, there's also been a longstanding well field there, that the water well field that supplies the actual irrigation water has been the focus of some geoscience-based research. In fact, if some of you met Jeff Niemitz yesterday, who was giving a poster as a geology faculty member, he actually started that well field. I have a colleague in my department who's a biochemist, actually a plant biochemist, who's used a project to grow grapevines on the farm and push the biochemical pathway that forms resveratrol, you know, this compound that is essentially anti-aging, aging compound, to try to actually increase resveratrol concentrations. And then we've even had first-year seminars that have done food production where they've raised, you know, broiler hens, raised them, slaughtered them, and cooked them. We can't say they ate them because they could have been vegan, but they had to go through the process of doing it. So there's been a lot of projects, science-based. I'll tell you a little bit more details about something I did this summer with Jessica Sinchi, who is there on the left, and Anna Farb, who some of you might have met out at the farm yesterday, who was giving a little demonstration of vermicompost. Vermicompost, of course, is a big deal in a lot of farming nowadays. It's some way to actually generate really fine compost. And there's been a long-standing sort of interest in extracts, water-based extracts generated from compost in general. You've probably heard of compost teas, compost extracts. So we tried to do some kind of systematic study of how these extracts might affect tomato plants in particular, in terms of disease resistance and some microbial characterizations as well. I should mention that this project was actually funded through the Dickinson Center for Sustainability Education here on campus, and also the National Science Foundation STEP program that's here at Dickinson, which actually allows for students from underrepresented groups to do science-based research. So the goals of the research was to compare, actually, vermicompost extracts versus a commercial organic product called Ceridane Max, which some of you may have heard of before. It's actually a monoculture of Bacillus subtilis, which is this one type of bacteria that's been shown to have a sort of antibiotic fungicidal effect. So, of course, you're comparing, essentially, this vermicompost extract, which is a really very, very high degree of microbial diversity, to essentially a monoculture approach. So we also were doing some very sort of preliminary characterization of the kinds of critters we have in the vermicompost, and to think how this might apply to the overall strategy. Here's just an image. That's actually a pretty small one of the worms there. This is the operation, which you again may have seen yesterday. There's the worm bin itself, where we have actually the compost. We actually the scraper mechanism that scrapes the compost out onto the ground here. We load it into this mesh bag, has about 150 micron mesh, plastic mesh, put it inside this tank, run it for 15 minutes or so with aeration, drain it out the bottom. That's the vermicompost extract. Now, you may wonder, well, why don't we do it longer? Why don't we add a carbon source? A lot of folks add molasses and things like that. If you look at the USDA regulations now in terms of compost extracts, if you use an extract within a few hours or don't add external carbon source, you can actually then harvest fruit immediately from. If you do those other manipulations, you have to wait. You have to actually cut off those treatments 90 days before harvest. So there's actually some restrictions on these kinds of applications if you don't do it in this manner. So I'm trying to do it in the most flexible way, I guess. Of course, this doesn't look like an organic farm, does it? Why do we go to this high-level PPE? We did that because, you know, we don't really know what's in the vermicompost extract. So if I had students working with me out there, I'm not just going to let them spray without any protective equipment. So we decided to go the whole nine yards. We actually just dressed up like this for the Serenade, because Serenade only requires is much more well characterized, obviously, in terms of pathogenicity. So what we did, we had a fairly large research field, 96 Estepa plants, and if you're looking for a great tomato hybrid that is highly productive and produces really beautiful fruit, I would recommend this Estepa. It's from Johnny Seeds in Maine. It's terrific. In any event, we had this random lock design, typical kind of thing, and we did this solar spraying. This was a field that had drip irrigation. It had it had a trellis system that we put in, and sort of all the typical kinds of stuff. And I'm a microscopist, so I look at things through microscopes. And if you want to look and see what bacteria are doing inside vermicompost, that's what they're doing. They're swimming around there. But that's not all you see. You actually see, this is actually a stalked amoeba. So this is a kind of protozoa you see actually in vermicompost. This is another kind of flagellated amoeba there. Protozoa you see. Here's nematodes as well, of course. And you can actually grow these, culture these guys also, of course, in agar plates as well, and do some initial kind of bacterial sort of characterization. And in case you're wondering what a fungal colony looks like relative to a bacterial one, the fungus is on the right there with all the little filaments growing out. We did some Gram staining, which is sort of the classic way to start characterizing bacteria, and then we actually saw a lot of rod-shaped Gram-negative bacteria out there as well. There was this basic question is about, well, can we tell how many of these bacteria are actually metabolically active or viable? Because this is a question about these extracts. And actually one of the methodologies in the field is to use some fluorescence-based methods to look at this. So one of these methods is shown, well, this is actually Gram stain, so I'll skip over that for now. One of these methods is shown here. You have a fluorescent dye that actually can incorporate into bacteria and only become fluorescent if those bacteria are genetically active. So this is sort of a metabolic activity assay. It's based on the dye carboxyfluorescein diacetate. And then we add another fluorescence-based method, which was using a dye called Cytox Green, which actually incorporates only into bacteria that have lost their membrane integrity, so they've died and actually binds to their DNA. So we had a couple of ways to look at this. And so this is a CFDA staining. So what you're looking at is all the bacteria are labeled with the DNA dyes. All these little blue dots you see are bacteria. But only the metabolically active bacteria are actually labeled with the green dye. And you can do quantitation of this as well. We found largely about 20 to 30% of the bacteria are metabolically active, which could in with some of the things in the literature as well. If you look at sort of dead bacteria, again, it's about in the 10 to 20% in terms of vermicompost, and we did somewhat of a control where if you let the compost sit for 24 hours, obviously the number of dead bacteria is a lot. Interesting enough, all the serinate bacteria took up this dye, which was kind of interesting to me. Anyway, so here's the field. This was actually right after our transplantation. You can see the drip irrigation. Here's about 8 weeks later with the Florida weave trellis effects. And you may ask, well, what happened late? And this is what happened late. Unfortunately, there was no real difference that we could discern between early blight infestation in these plants versus serenade, vermicompost, and controls. As many of you who farm in this area know, there was two extreme weather events in the middle of the tomato harvest season this year, Hurricane Irene and Tropical Depression Lee. And both of those led to significant fruit loss, unfortunately, for us. So I think it's kind of an incomplete experiment at this point. We did some photosynthetic efficiency measurements using a barometer. It's a way to actually look at photosynthetic efficiencies of plants at different stages. And we didn't see much difference there either. Here's the actual fruit production. And as you can see, we're doing really well until Hurricane Irene. And we essentially lost all harvestable fruit at that point. And at that point, also, I think the early blight, which had been pretty much curtailed because of the lack of moisture, actually sort of taking over. We never saw any instances of predator presence there, but late blight yet. But I know there have been some reports of late blight in Pennsylvania this season. So I think it's kind of an incomplete experiment at this point. And there's more. I think I'm going to go to the future directions only because I think this is, in some respects, more interesting. Right now, Anna Farb, who worked on this project with me, is actually continuing this research by looking at vermicompost, essentially supplementation of potting soils. So it's another idea that the farm is interested in, is trying to increase the germination efficiencies and the actual survivorship of plants that are actually seedlings in vermicompost supplementation. She's actually started that project and started her transplantations, starting to get some interesting results. And as I said, I already mentioned the funding stream here, but really the most important elements of this research were Jan Halpin's contributions and Matt Steinem. They run a fantastic operation at the farm. It's hard for me to describe what it's like to be out with undergraduates in the summer in 110 degree heat for 10 hours, and then they come back the next day just willing to get at it again. So, I mean, it's an amazing operation and transformative, really, for the students out there. I was fortunate to work with two students from underrepresented groups, disadvantaged backgrounds, funded through NSF. And in these kids, really had the opportunity to really do some interesting work out at the farm, and they found it to be really, really something, I think, again, sort of transformative for them. So I'm going to stop there because I have a short talk, and because I'm giving room for my other presenter, and I'll take some questions. Neil, is that right? Are we on time now? There you are. Okay. Questions? Yeah.
Curious, how have you integrated the research with the production piece? With the products that came out of a lot of the research, are you still able to market those in most cases?
Yeah, what we did, of course, there is no restriction on this, even though we put the kids in the Tyvek suits, there's no restriction on this kind of harvestable fruit in terms of production. And so, sure, yeah, that was just incorporated into the normal farm stands and CSA. Yeah. And actually, that was an extraordinarily productive field, period, in terms of the production of the actual tomatoes. So, yeah. And in fact, I will say anecdotally that all the faculty neighbors and stuff that I gave tomatoes to said those were the best tomatoes they had all summer. I can't quantify that. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any advice on motivating students to take that next step and get out? And we were talking earlier about how impressive it is once they get to the farm and start working. But even just on the break, if I said something to my students about research projects and they made this face and they're like, students don't do research products.
Yeah.
So getting them to get going, and I think once they get started, but what about that first step?
Yeah, I think one thing that's successful is, the teaching laboratories that use the farm, because you expose a lot of students to it. So I even take my infectious disease versus immune defense course lab out to the farm, because of course we look at biocontrol and we look at the relationship between pathogens and hosts at the farm. And I think that just bring the students out there seeing a sort of a context for research and seeing what kinds of things are being done, that tends to motivate students to go out there and do things. But yeah, it is sort of an activation energy kind of thing to do. But I think most students, once they get out to the farm, see how people are really passionate about it. It does help. Yeah.
These are such interesting and diverse projects. Are all of these collected anywhere, like on a website or anything? I'd love to share this with my colleagues to give them some ideas.
No, that's a great idea. In some cases, I think there are individual faculty that have on their website and talk about it. But you're right; we don't tend to collect this. It'd be nice if from the farm's website here, Dickinson, you could link to these projects are being done. The same manner that your faculty are doing projects of where you are, it'd actually be really nice if there was some kind of a way to collect all that. Because I think that you want faculty buy-in. What they want to do is see, can I do something that's interesting my research? Involve students, and if they see examples of a lot of interesting projects, they say, well, that's something that you could really or incorporate into my teaching or into my research. So,
The projects that were funded by our center, we collected that kind of information for them, so that maybe about half the ones that John was talking about.
Yeah.
We probably should look at collecting that information, whether we funded it or not. We've got that information, it's not on the web because we've been in this process over a year waiting for a redesign of the website that's supposed to happen for us. And so we've got all this stuff sitting there not accessible as we've been thinking, oh, next month we'll be ready to subscribe to our own long time.
Any other questions? Yeah.
Just to piggyback on that, I work at an institution that also is not an ag school or has any interest in being an ag school. I would say a tough time because there's no shortage of ideas to get faculty down to our garden / opening farm today. But can you talk about are faculty members kind of stretching their research interests a little bit to
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to be careful. I know that the speaker from Mercer just said that you have to be tenured. I'm a full professor with endowed chairs. Whereas, a true faculty member, you may want to argue that they don't want to get too involved in research outside of the field, and I can appreciate that. However, having said that, a very prominent figure in my field, Ben Bruce Alpert, I was mentioning this to a colleague earlier, one of the most preeminent scientists in the United States, president of the Academy of Sciences for a while. I remember being at a conference when he said that if all scientists have to incorporate sustainability into their research in some way, period. Because if you don't do it, it's in your teaching or research, even if you're figuring out something to do with what you're doing in your own research, it doesn't make sense otherwise if science is not doing that. So I think that admonition is something that is important, because his point was that if science doesn't turn its direction towards sustainability, we're not going to have much future in science. So I think that was something that I really took to heart. But part of it also is that once you have this kind of facility, this faculty who come in, new faculty, you get to know the kinds of things you can do, and also the student body that comes to be. Also focused towards that. So there's no question that over the last 5 years we've drawn a cohort of students to Dickinson extremely interested in these kinds of things. And they tend to, influence the rest of the campus, for sure. I think I better stop there, because I know Tony's going to have to start his presentation. So. Okay. There you go.
I'm the odd man out here as the studio artist, I'm feeling, especially following John's presentation. I was struck immediately this morning by at 7:30 that art conferences start much, much later in the day. And break around 3 for drinks. But I appreciate y'all coming to the session. And again, I teach here at Dickinson College. I'm an assistant professor. I'm a sculptor. The very first semester I was here, I was able to go out to the college farm as part of just an open invite. Hey, everyone come out, see if you can see any potential in this for your classes. And I got out there and I was just struck, because it's an amazing place for sculptors. And I'll talk a little bit about what the art department in general has done, but most of the talk will be about how it interfaces with sculpture and some of the student projects we've done out there. Now, when I introduce farm art to the students, the very first thing they're thinking of, like so many people, are tool-based art or butter sculptures and things like that. And of course, actually, there's a lot you can draw from this kind of cultural association with farms. But, of course, we're also pushing them to be a bit more in line with an art historical context of land art and things like that. So over the past couple of years, we've had faculty members take students out to do photography-based projects, which seems like a natural interface. It's a beautiful landscape. You go out, you can shoot that, as well as a place to conduct drawing courses or drawing classes or plein air painting classes. And you think about things like, like greenhouses, which are so complex as forms. It's like a drawing professor's dream. It's a student's nightmare to go out there and have to draw the reflectivity, maybe, or the transparency. But a great site to take drawing and painting students, their little portable easels. Very soon, we have a visiting professor, who's going to go out and do a ceramic pit firing out there. So we're gathering materials for that now. So that's another one. And of course, like I mentioned, a sculpture. Again, I get out there, I'm dumbstruck by what I see. The most important resource is space. And that's for a couple of reasons. Firstly, it allows us the opportunity and the flexibility to respond to different sites within the acreage of the farm. So it's options. Two, it allows us to take multiple students out and sort of compose an exhibition, right? So room to breathe. We have students out there who are being pushed to do ambitiously scaled sculpture. We're pulling it from the tabletop or the pedestal top and hopefully doing things bigger than they can fit in the back of their cars is what I like to scale it by. So that they have to work with us and facilities here on campus to get their sculptures out there and get them set up. So once we're out there, we kind of need elbow room in order to have multiple students involved. With space two, I had another one for space. We'll move on to reduced risk. What that means is when you install a sculpture, let's say on campus, a public sculpture, especially a student-made sculpture, you have a risk of this thing hurting or falling or someone climbing on it and getting hurt in some way. Out at the farm, we have a bit more flexibility with that. Big windstorm comes through, let's say, and that sculpture topples for one reason or another. It's not as likely to do any damage to a facility or to a person. But also, and more importantly, of course, we work very hard to make sure these things are absolutely safe, sort of by the school standards, which are quite high. But the reduced risk environment is also about that idea of time to install. A sculpture could take up to a week, possibly, to install. And if you were doing that in a much more public setting, like here on campus, you would have to set up more barriers and have better communication about when people can approach it, when it's ready. And with contemporary art, it's often hard to tell when it's done anyways. So it's great to have that flexibility. And it's a really important part of their experience, the student experience, to be out there installing it themselves. And again, they make mistakes. This is the first time they've done stuff like this. So again, it's safer from a teaching perspective. The farm is pre-equipped, right? So not only are there just tons of raw materials, there's this plenty of hand tools around. There's a tractor. You know, whenever we want to erect a large sculpture anywhere near campus, it means scheduling a forklift and all this other stuff. Here, out at the farm, it's a matter of asking Matt, hey, Matt, come over here, and we lift up something up, and we're done. So it's equipped. And, of course, that equipment, or the idea of being equipped, also includes many hands, right? All the volunteers that are out there, the student helpers, the farm managers, having those extra hands when you need them, especially in sculpture, is a big deal. And they have a truck, pickup truck. Off-campus experiences, another great reason to sort of migrate students out to the farm, at least here, and I can imagine that many of the other institutions that y'all are from, you know, in the classroom, it's one thing. Again, they make the work. They're showing it to their peers in class or perhaps across campus in a kind of gallery or exhibition context. But really, that level of public interface is such a huge part of art making. And this is, while it's still an extension of the campus, for sure, it's this opportunity to interface with a different public. Of course, the farm has their own community of folks that come there that might not be associated, school groups, things like that. So it's a great kind of mediated public. So that's a good thing. And again, like I mentioned before, the idea, the physicality, the labor involved in making ambitiously scaled sculpture and transporting it is too part of the art making experience. Okay, there's also tons to respond to creatively out there. And that might include things like the dynamic landscape. And dynamic, of course, you guys probably know this better than I do, but we're not just talking about the four seasons, we're talking about the way the landscape changes within a growing cycle or multiple growing cycles, the buildings that go up for some things, the thing that does that thing that you're not sure what it does, that's me, because I'm not sure what half of your equipment does out there. But it's crazy the way these things shift within this landscape. The farm has a history, right? So letting students have the opportunity to respond to that history is a great thing. Having perhaps photo students come out and document the farm with the future, you know, research, people looking back on the farm in mind as part of a photojournalistic kind of take on documenting the farm. Sounds like a great project to me. I already mentioned the architectural structures on the farm. That's something that, again, the students can respond to, that the idea of either just as geometric forms versus curvilinear natural forms on a base level, but also what these structures represent to the farm. Processes inherent to the farm. Boy, that could be just about anything. You can draw inspiration from the kind of metaphors of growing and sowing and reaping to what it takes to maintain a tractor, let's say. All these things, the students research, they draw from, they try to figure out. A lot of those processes aren't so different than the processes I might be doing in a sculpture studio where we're teaching students to weld or to use a wood shop or to work with their hands in clay, dirt, you know. And of course, the farm's mission itself of sustainability and stewardship, and these are big ideas, and the students love drawing this into their work. They're much more keyed into it than my generation, for sure. So it's already kind of on their minds. Okay, so what happens? Well, a student just doesn't come up and put out a sculpture. There is some rigor involved, and I did want to illustrate that. Oops, I got a jump there. Okay, so we'd start with an independent or class site visit, just to get a feel for where the farm even is, which is a big part of the education process, I think, with our college farmers, letting students know that we have it, and it's you got to go that way to get to it. That's a big part of it. So letting them know it's there, letting them, so we can establish a kind of common vocabulary when we're talking about the farm, everyone has to do a site visit. Then, ideally, we would meet with the farm managers to learn more about the mission, to understand more about what they're looking from a collaboration, right? Everyone's taking notes with the farm managers at that point. Students are then encouraged to make multiple proposals, minimum of 3, sometimes up to 5, for different things they would like to explore, different sculptures they would like to make that respond specifically to the site. Those project proposals then would be shown to the farm managers, shown to the class. We would decide from those one that the students would want to pursue. They would go ahead and make a model, a scale model, again, to show the farm managers. And part of this is about communication with the farm managers as a kind of client. And we're looking at the public art private sector to some degree, this idea of commissions when we're introducing this idea to students. That there's a professionalism, there's this idea of the farm managers as our client, that we need to meet some of their needs as well as be expressive, personally expressive in what we're doing. We would then fabricate the sculptures either on our facilities here on campus or out at the farm. We would install the sculptures, which I mentioned earlier, and of course we would then basically critique them or talk about what kind of grade they would get. And I'd like to involve the farm managers in that aspect as well to get their input, how well the sculptures met the expectations or needs of the farm. And so now I'm just going to kind of run through real quick some of the projects we've done. Christian Mead in 2008 proposed an honors project, and Christian, out of his many proposals, was most drawn to this idea of perfect aesthetic landscape vantages, where he thought the landscape in the distance was most ideal. And so he set up a number of chairs with these framing devices that you would sit in the chair and you could see this vista that he identified as being kind of worthy. Fabricated in steel and wood, had to have been made, he had to make it modularly, we had to move it out there in many parts, assembled on site. Again, really important that the students are involved in all levels of installation, design, and even in terms of leading a public through it, at least at a kind of soft opening. The chairs there. One of the chairs was double-backed, so the two students could sit back-to-back, which was really quite elegant. The farm was also interested in having stations where people could walk around and rest. And so this met a couple different criteria. And here again, you can see one of the kind of framed out little landscapes he was interested in. And he was a combination photographer, sculptor, and I think this makes a lot of sense when you think about the viewfinder of a camera. More recently, I ran a public sculpture class specifically where the students had to basically propose a sculpture for the farm. So an entire class is doing this now, and I picked a couple. This is Laura Wilson, one of those overachieving kind of students. One of the things that the farm wanted to do was they asked if we would be interested in using cob, which is kind of a traditional mud, straw, sand material, like adobe, basically, to do a bench or something. And none of the students were keen on a bench. A lot of them liked the idea of cob. Laura ran with that and made a kind of a learning wall for the Discovery Garden, for the children's garden there. And these are some photos from her installation process. There was a little pool, and the idea was maybe it would keep kids away from the pool. I don't know if that was totally successful. Anything that draws kids towards it. Of course, it was only accessible, really, for kids from one side. And this is part of that construction process. So within these little tubes, She would put these caps and color them. This is the final thing. And the children who are visiting the garden, some of these would hold little shovels or little seed bags. Other things is where, or other tubes would be empty where students could put things that they found of interest for other students to share. A great idea. Again, we were able to meet some of those requirements of the farm in terms of the location and the materials. But the student got to make a lot of decisions on her own about the actual aesthetic of it, including the tires, which was not in the original proposal but added after an initial critique. Sarah Fields did this largest, and these students have very little experience, at most one sculpture class under their belt at this point. None of them had experience with things like welding. So this student was learning a lot about those other processes at the time. She was responding specifically to one of the farm meetings we went to and a flock of starlings flying overhead and thought, boy, I love that dynamic energy. I want to put that into a sculpture and have that sense of motion, even when, let's say, there's not wind or something blowing, because this is like a whirligig. They spin in the wind. Each unit of three birds is on a bearing, and so if it's a windy day, they kind of move around a little. It's hit or miss, depending on the direction of the wind. But an ambitious project, you know, a three-day install for that student, and multiple site visits, and again, lots of that chance for collaboration with the farm staff. And lastly, Ramin here did, interested in those issues of sustainability and global education and global impact. Took it quite literally, but still a nice idea to do a kind of globe on campus to on the site to remind folks visiting about the impact of the actions out there. Designed to rust, so this is early on before it's really rusted out very much. Okay. Still tons to do. In the early stages of designing a public arts or participating in designing a public arts rotating program on campus where we could bring in art and set it on sculpture pads and switch it out every 2 or 3 years, I would love to include the farm as part of that, not only to help drive traffic between the two areas, but just because out there we can do even larger, more ambitious things. Land art experiences, things that maybe are less invasive than plunking down a sculpture, even if those sculptures respond to the site, the idea of using a backhoe to intervene into the earth, or to do things where we could do more natural kind of stackings or things along those lines. There's all sorts of ways we could work with what's out there and not bring in anything else from the sculpture studios. As a site for sculpture-based intensives, things like iron pours or these pits-firing ceramics, great community builders. It'd be great to have something like an iron pour where we'd invite schools from the region to come and join us in this kind of social art-building experience. It's an extension of the art initiatives, community art initiatives, hopefully working with, again, things like children's groups out there where our students could lead them through a number of art projects. And then lastly, just ongoing opportunities for exhibition, whether it's a beautiful New York-style white gallery or an old barn. I mean, I think there's all sorts of possibility for still taking work from here and showing it out there and giving it a new context. So that's what I have, and I'm happy to take questions if there are any. Yeah.
Have you considered topiary art as a possibility for actually using live material?
Absolutely. You know, and I've had a number of students basically start down that path and basically get scared off because of the amount of work and engineering involved.
It's 10 years to get the finished.
Well, there's that. But you know, they could even to build, and there are some artists, contemporary artists, doing this where they'll build a structure and they'll put potted plants in. And they'll build up a kind of topiary structure off of potted plants. But, yeah, I would love to see stuff like that. And hopefully the students they see the connectivity there. Someone else had a question. Yeah.
Students come, students go. Sculpture lasts a long time. Who maintains them? Who maintains the land?
That's a great question. Students come, students go. These sculptures last a little bit. Again, they're not necessarily made with the same level of longevity that a public commission, an official public commission might. Right now, it's me. If you go out to the farm, or if you're out at the farm, you'll see some are crazy overgrown. We've offered to go out and remove those. The farm managers are still attached to, I guess it's serving as a kind of habitat now, so maybe there's something else going on there. I think, too, we've only just really started doing this. I hope you begin to get more ambitious with our programming, in which case we'd have to eventually remove work. The students themselves aren't bound to come back and remove it, but they kind of understand. You know, maybe a contract is basically what we're looking at, where they realize after 3 years I'll be taking their sculpture down. Yeah.
So, I mean, you're doing this, and it's really wonderful. It's
Thank you.
To see you doing this. How about your other colleagues in the art department? Are they as receptive to
this? Oh, absolutely. And like I said, we have faculty members taking students out there on a regular basis. I think we need to figure out... That distance is our biggest issue. You know, to be able to go out there within a class period, and our classes for studio art are already really short at 2 hours. It's almost impossible to run a regular class. We're used to teaching a minimum of 3 hour blocks in a lot of institutions. So that kind of contact time is really what we need more than anything. So what we're kind of looking at is we have a student senate funded arts collective, and trying to get them more involved, and they can then draw in other students as well, and then we could go in and lead workshops out there. I think that's probably that's going to be the most successful way, without attaching it directly to a kind of focused class.
I'm curious if there's much discussion between the art world and the artisan worlds, as you get things that are both practical and aesthetic.
Well, I mean, it is a point of tension in the larger art world, for sure, or a point of conversation, let's say. Here, I mean, that's a perfect teaching device for me, you know, to bring those questions up and to let them respond and let them research and find out where they want to sit on that. Because the way we train them here, it can point equally well in other directions or in either direction. Certainly, ceramics is something that is always facing that challenge. And some of the more traditional processes, whether it be sculpting with clay or the welding, and you know, has those other implications as well. But we've entertained proposals that include using projections and using LED lights, and you know, it's an anything goes kind of. I mean, the farm still has some limitations in terms of what we can do right now, but I think that's changing in terms of technology and things. Yes.
Have you ever had any discussions about how they would design the practical elements of the farm in a more aesthetic way?
We're gonna a little bit. We would love to be more involved in some of those processes, not just out there, but here as well on campus. Yeah. Within the meetings we've had, they have invited us to do things. I think one of the things was a compost tea holder. I guess it goes through, and the students could design and be a part of building that, whether it's made out of stainless steel or made out of a more traditional material or ceramic material. That seems like a great way for us to kind of interface. But again, they have a vision and they have of the aesthetic they want out there. So it's always going to be in collaboration, you know. And I don't think it's so much a territoriality. It's just the nature of any kind of art making, especially when it's so site specific. It'd be irresponsible not to respond to them and just plunk down a big kind of machine or something that we like, but they don't. Oh, yeah.
I'm curious about how different departments began collaborating with the farm, and if you know any other departments.
Artists, I can only speak for the artists. Artists like free stuff, and basically, they tempt us with food every so often, and we go out, and then they get us, and we just, you know, I think for every art department member, it's about space, and you go out there, and you look, and you just sort of are overwhelmed. Theater and dance, I'm not sure if they've done anything out there, but that would be a great site for them, as well as you know, taking poetry classes out there, any of the arts, you know.
Social sciences?
Oh, I'm sure.
As a way to integrate the farm into what you're talking about in their classes or groups.
bit of money along with
it. So the answer, we've had some students put out theater performance about wind fields, and of course, they're worried about weather. But yeah, a lot of space. And one student was following the field of horses while they played, going on. That's part of the spectrum. They got a lot of room to do stuff.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's so different than what they're used to in the classroom. And that's the biggest experience right there. Thank you.